B is, I'm supposed to tell you you're breaking in a new partner in on this.
Partner again?
Yeah, some cat he's on loan from Dope. Real burnout, on the ragged edge.
Oh, perfect.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Lethal Weapon Retrospective Series.
How are you, boys?
Join Garrett.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
Matt.
I'm surprised you haven't heard about me. You know, I got a bad reputation, and sometimes I just go nuts like now.
And Adam.
You're my family and my friends.
As they review all four films in the seminal Richard Donner-directed action franchise starring Mel Gibson and Danny Glover.
I'm warning you.
Will Adam be able to recover after reviewing the entire Children of the Corn series?
God hates me, that's what it is.
Hate him back, it works for me.
Why did Matt want to do this series so bad?
You really are crazy.
And will Garrett still adore these films now, just as much as he did in his teens?
Come on, be original. Say yes, everyone else says no. Come on with me.
Find out the answers to these questions, as well as many more.
Do you really want to jump? Do you want to?
Coming up next, courtesy of Percolated Media.
Well, we go on three.
Three, on three.
One, two, and like
three.
Yeah? Okay. On three.
Three.
One.
Two. Three!
Lethal Weapon, released March 6th, 1987. Good time for a Christmas movie. Budget on this, $15 million. Box office, $120.2 million. And this is directed by, returning to the Percolated Media airwaves, the late Mr. Richard Donner. It is time to talk buddy cop films. I didn't think we'd ever get to this series, honestly. If you listen to the end of our Children of the Corn 2020 review, where if you haven't, Red Adam goes real red and almost explodes on that particular podcast, we mentioned that we were going to do Lethal Weapon, and Matt, you expressed that you were surprised we hadn't gotten to this yet. You made the schedule. You put this on the schedule. Why did you put this on the schedule?
Well, number one, it's apropos of the time of year. You know, we're still in the post-holiday season, and this is a Christmas movie, as is almost everything this screenwriter has done in one way or another. And number two, I like things that, even if there's no tie-in, we can at least say there's some kind of lead-in in Mad Max. We've done Mel Gibson. That's one big franchise he's known for, and this is the other one. So I said, why not? Because I was like, you know, I don't want to do Die Hard, because I wouldn't have as much to say about Die Hard as I would about these movies, and this came out first.
It did, and I think people get lost in that. They think that Die Hard was the quintessential action film of the late 80s, but no, this is the one that kind of started that buddy cop thing. Yeah, we had like Red Heat and stuff like that, but there wasn't really this mixture, and we'll talk about it, but this wasn't actually originally written as a black and white cop. I want to continue with our origins, though. Adam, sir, you and I have quite a history with this particular franchise. Why don't you discuss your individual history before we get to what we did?
Yeah, so this movie comes out, I'm still, so 87, so you figure I'm still 9 years old at this point. So this is just the VHS that's around the house. This is a staying up late watching on HBO type of film for this first one, and probably the second one as well. But when it came in time for like the third one, fourth one, this is a franchise that just existed through my teenage years. So it was just watched. It was watched on TV. It was watched censored on things like TBS and stuff like that. Go over to my grandpa's house. Of course, he's watching it. So this series was just a part of growing up, all of them. But more so, probably the second and third ones, which I think almost like Terminator 2 to Terminator and things like that, where the sequels kind of take things into a stratosphere. So it'd been a while since I've seen this one, the original Lethal Weapon, and I was trying to remember parts of what I enjoyed, parts of what I feel really put its stamp on this and make it stand out different from some other ones, and I can't wait to discuss it. Since I was in single digits, this franchise has existed for me. This is where I got introduced to Mel Gibson, to Danny Glover, to Gary Busey. This kind of film, this kind of buddy cop film. I believe this would have been the first one. And when we discuss it, I'm going to say where I think this really came from. But I think this was my first.
I have a weird history with Lethal Weapon, beginning with the fact that the first one wasn't the one that introduced me to it. In 1987, the first one just kind of came and went. I didn't really pay any attention to it. I think I really started paying attention around the time Lethal Weapon 2 had come out. That was the first one I'd ever seen. And then it was followed quickly by a reviewing of this one. And then Lethal Weapon 3 came out. I didn't see it in theaters. I rented it. But the thing is, after those first two and the third one, as a teenager, I watched these like crazy. I watched these so many times. And leading into the release of the fourth one, Adam came over, and me and him stayed up all night. We marathoned the first three, and we went and saw the fourth one the next day. And here's the funny thing. The funny thing is that it hit me as I turned this on to watch for this particular viewing. I hadn't seen this, Adam, since we did that marathon viewing, which is crazy to me because that was way back in 1998. But I had seen it so many times, I didn't really need to watch it because I knew every single line that was going to come next. So, yeah, my teenage years were really filled with a lot of Lethal Weapon viewing. Hadn't really watched it since. And, of course, we'll discuss it when we get to the fourth one, but I didn't really watch the TV series. I'm kind of thinking about diving into the TV series, even though I'm knee-deep in the Dead Zone right now, preparing for that particular review when we finally get to that. Maybe I'll get to it, maybe I won't, but I haven't really watched these since. Now, let's get to the origins of this. As Matt mentioned, this movie was written by Shane Black, and Shane Black had quite a 1987. He had this. He had Predator, which he also, according to reports, also worked on the script a little bit during that filming. And he had the Monster Squad, which I hope we never get to review.
He did Monster Squad? I had no idea.
He was a co-writer on it, yeah.
Fred Decker directed it, but they're like best friends.
Yeah, they were best friends, so Fred Decker brought him in.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Do some rewrites on it. This was the one that turned him into a wunderkind. You know, he had just graduated from UCLA. And the thing about Shane Black's script is... we'll discuss it, but what finally appeared on screen was not nearly as dark as that original script. It was greenlit because, according to people who had read it, and I haven't read it yet, but it is very descriptive. Like, his scripts read like novels. And I read a report that said at one point in the script, I think it was Donner who said it, he said that at one point it says during an action scene that the cars traded paint. And, you know, if you get that descriptive, you're going to get greenlit. But Joel Silver got a hold of the script, really liked it. He wanted Ridley Scott to come in and do this. But Ridley Scott did not have a good time working with Warner Brothers when he did Blade Runner. Turned it down rather quick. Matt, had you heard that?
No, I didn't realize that Ridley Scott was... I mean, look, Ridley was still paying back from all the money he lost making Legend.
Yeah, that's true. So they bring in Richard Donner to do it. They originally actually, you know, before they brought in Richard Donner, there was another director that they wanted, which is a very unusual choice.
Yeah,
Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, Mr. Spock directing Lethal Weapon.
To do this, who, unsurprisingly, was like, I do more comedic stuff. And he ended up doing Three Men and a Baby instead of this movie. But wow, and Leonard Nimoy directed Lethal Weapon. That would have been interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on a lot of... The thing you also have to remember, Shane Black was like 22 when he wrote this script.
Yeah.
And he sort of had the Tarantino, like, accelerated fast track. I think they're very comparable in that way, except Black, you know, didn't start directing movies until much later in his career. But that script was also like 150 pages, which is, if you're doing the math, mm-hmm. it's one page is about a minute's worth of screen time. So you're talking a 2.5-hour movie. There is a director's cut of Lethal Weapon out there that came out afterwards. But, you know, you talk about Joel Silver. I mean, you know, I could do my impression of him just by pretending to snort cocaine and have that covered, you know, because you talk about 1987. This is the producer who would do this and Die Hard.
Yeah.
A year apart from each other. Okay, the buddy cop. It's not that Lethal Weapon invented it, because you could argue 48 Hours is kind of a buddy cop movie. And that was, what, 5 years before this?
Yep, 1982.
Mm-hmm. But I think the real genesis is Freebie and the Bean with Alan Arkin and James Caan, because that movie was originally intended to be much more serious. But because they were so good at ad-libbing and playing off each other, it sort of morphed into something a little bit more comedic. And I think it's not that Lethal Weapon was the first one, but I think much like Die Hard, it spawned so many imitators that people confuse it as being the genesis of the genre. I mean, look, the Lethal Weapon imitators, I grew up at the time where it was like Rush Hour was kind of the spiritual successor. I mean, it's almost the same in a lot of ways. We'll talk about more with the sequels, how they kind of changed. But parodies, you had a literal parody of Lethal Weapon put out by National Lampoon. But yeah, the Donner thing is surprising, because you look at right before this, he did The Goonies, which mm-hmm. I feel about The Goonies the way Garrett feels about Monster Squad.
And the same way I feel about Goonies, too, actually. Yeah, Donner's career is so weird, because we covered him when we did Superman. And that, of course, is probably what he'll be most remembered by. But before that, he was in horror. He did The Omen. He had so many weird movies after that. He did Lady Hawk, which was weird. The Toy, which is one of the most insensitive, sensitive comedies you've ever seen. Go back and listen to our Superman 3 review if you want to hear my thoughts on that. I did a movie called Inside Moves, which I hear is actually really good. I never did see.
Yeah, he did like right after he got booted off Superman 2.
And then right after this, he did Scrooge. We have Radio Flyer, Maverick, Assassins, Conspiracy Theory. His directing resume is so diversified. I just don't see him doing a quintessential action franchise, but here we are.
I find it fascinating because, yeah, I think a lot of people think of Donner, they automatically go to Superman for a very good reason. You absolutely can't fault anybody for that. But you look at it and you're like, Scrooged, The Toy, Assassins, you know, Goonies. He is really like a renaissance man of directing. Was, you know, rest in peace. And I think he's just underrated as a director for the different things he did and the different types of genres he worked in, because not everybody can. And at this point, he would have been an inspired choice to come in for this type of film. It would have been a who? What guy? So surprising choice here, but it's amazing what he's done afterwards.
Well, he also broke the template. This franchise, we'll talk about how it kind of put this subgenre into a new level. It's also a rarity of all these action film franchises. It's very rare to have the same director do all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, because Bond went through all the people. Die Hard's multiple directors. Predator. So the fact that
especially
he did
one of them hits.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this obviously did gangbusters, but the fact that he did all four of them is kind of a rarity with action genre franchises.
And this same year, he would produce The Lost Boys, which you'll see a marquee for during the course of this film. So quite a crazy career. And don't forget, he also produced the first X-Men as well.
He almost directed it.
Yeah, almost directed it. Maybe we'll get to that eventually. Let's talk about our two stars, beginning with Danny Glover. Now, if I were to put these two stars together in 1987, Danny Glover would have had the better box office resume, because let's not forget, before this, he was in The Color Purple and he was in Witness. Two films where, by the way, he was the bad guy in. Very unconventional choice. And they had already had Mel Gibson, and the casting director had brought up, why don't we just bring Danny Glover in? And Richard Donner, without even thinking, was like, but he's black. And then he's like, wait a second, I'm a liberal. Yeah, that would work. If you hear him on the commentary, that's what he says. But I don't know, Danny Glover, interesting choice.
Yeah, I mean, respected actor, obviously, and Color Purple was a mainstream hit. But I would not associate him with this role on paper. But it's also important to note that the script makes no set ethnicity to what he mm-hmm. is. So the fact that he's black was kind of, you know, immaterial in a lot of ways. But from what I understand, Donner wanted to work with Mel Gibson for a long time. But, God, you read the names that were considered for Riggs, it's insane.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, the big one that was considered for Riggs was Bruce Willis. But he was doing another one at that time. I think it was Blind Date. But Mel Gibson, he actually turned down Die Hard, which, imagine that. Imagine flipping those roles, boys. Imagine flipping Bruce Willis and Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson stars in Die Hard. Bruce Willis stars in this. You have two really different films.
But it's funny you mentioned that, because that's not the only time those two franchises will be tied. Because if you know your history, Die Hard 3 was originally a Lethal Weapon script.
It was, definitely. I was going to get to that when we talked about Lethal Weapon 3. But so Mel Gibson, look, he was the first People magazine sexiest man of the year, by the way. So he was known for that. Yet he didn't really have a big American hit. I think of Mad Max as Australian imports, honestly. He had tried to do little roles to kind of bring up a little bit of Oscar bait, which wasn't really going many places for him. But he turned down The Untouchables and he turned down Die Hard to do this. This was way before we heard Mad Mel. This is before he went crazy. Adam, were you a Mel Gibson fan around this time?
Around this time, I wouldn't have been able to pick him out of a lineup. I don't think I'd seen Mad Max at the time. And yeah, I'll agree. Those are almost feel like foreign imports until you get to Beyond Thunderdome. Thank you, Tina Turner. So, no, this would have been my introduction to those big baby blues that he puts up on screen throughout.
Matt, you mentioned the other contenders. Christopher Lambert. Christopher Reeve was approached. We had Michael Biehn was a contender at one point. Other names, Pierce Brosnan, Ron Perlman, Sylvester Stallone, Patrick Swayze, Michael Douglas, Jeff Goldblum, and Kurt Russell. Those are some of the people that they had approached to do this. Matt, quite a list, huh?
Yes, and you could tell, though, that they didn't based on this list, they weren't really casting with the character in mind. They were just looking for a name for a lot of these. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Stallone, obviously Michael Douglas has the family lineage. Kurt Russell was a known name. Brosnan's weird because that's like 10 years before. Like, Remington Steele, was that running in 87?
I think it started in 89, didn't it?
I think it was about, yeah, I think it was about 2 years before. So it was close, but it wouldn't have been going yet. He was known, but not as that.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a world where I can see Bruce Willis in this and Mel Gibson and Die Hard. Outside of that, I think it worked out for the best for all parties involved.
Same with The Fly, with, you know, you flip Goldblum and Mel, you know, and you could kind of see that sliding doors. They would obviously be different movies, but I could see at least why they would want either one of them for those respective films.
I feel like they consider Christopher Reeve just because Richard Donner was directing.
Probably.
Because he was very abhorred violence. As we'll talk about, I mean, this is an action movie, but look, the 80s was the heyday of action films, if you ask me. Like, and it's not even close. But this comes out when Schwarzenegger's in his prime. The unstoppable killing machine, high body count action films were well in mainstay. So casting two schmoes for all intents and purposes, which Die Hard gets all the credit for, but you have to remember this came first.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really like, you know, going against the grain in a lot of ways. Because even if you remove Schwarzenegger's filmography, you still had Stallone doing a lot of movies. You had even stuff like Beverly Hills Cop. I mean, that's more of a comedy, but still got action in it.
Well, yeah, and Stallone was originally intended for that, too, which we'll dive into if we ever get to Beverly Hills Cop. All right, that's all the background I have. Matt, do you have anything else to add before we dive into this?
No, I'm just, there's a part of me that wanted to do this as a whole Shane Black Christmas, but we'd have to delve into other franchises, so it'd be kind of cheating, because he's done so much, and I'm heartbroken that I saw Mark Wahlberg as the star of his next movie. That just breaks my heart, because I'm like, he's not right. I've read the book it's based on, and he's not right for that role at all.
Hopefully, as soon as we get that Long Kiss Goodnight sequel, we'll do an entire Shane Black retro.
Oh, God.
Hey, Shane Black has made subpar directors look great because of his scripts.
And he's also made his own writing look bad with his own directing. Maybe one day we'll get to his stuff. But
well, we've already talked about his Predator movie, which I don't even think he... I think AI wrote that and they just used his name.
And directed it.
Let's talk about it if we do go back into Predator. So we open up with Jingle Bell Rock being played in the background. Matt, let's get into this right now.
Yes.
This is... all sense and purposes, a Christmas movie. And you touched on it in the beginning, Shane Black and his scripts are pretty hand-in-hand with Christmas. I read an interview with him where he said the reason why he does that is because there's a real universal theme when it comes to Christmas. People are either feeling really good or really bad, and you can really dive into the drama behind that. What do you think about his tendency to really revolve a lot of the scripts around Christmas?
I think it's just a great hallmark for... no pun intended, because Hallmark has cornered the market on Christmas movies. But I think he's got a very particular style for his writing. You know, it starts here. But the Christmas motif, I think it's always fun because his quote is very authentic. You know, people are either on cloud nine or it's their like least favorite time of year. And it also adds the built-in, I don't want to call it pressure, but when you do like chase scenes in movies... on a highway, and you're like, why are all these cars out here at 2 a.m. or whatever? Well, this movie answers that because it takes place during Christmas. I think it's cool, but it's also like a noirish type of thing, which almost all of his movies have in some degree, because, you know, this movie is instigated by a murder case.
I usually like it, and a lot of times that kind of repetitiveness gets on my nerves, but it sets a tone, it sets a time. It also gives you a window that something is going to be set in. He's giving himself... I don't want to say bumpers because that's not fair. It's giving himself structure to this is where it's going to fit. This is the time frame it's going to fit in. He gives himself a season. And you know what? Good for him. It works for him. He likes it. I'm not going to say every film is good because of it, but I don't mind it usually.
So this Jingle Bell Rock dissolves into the Michael Kamen score that we become familiar with throughout the course of this series as a girl, complete with a titty shot, wakes up, dazed, smiling, doing a line of coke. I have a feeling Joel Silver had a lot of nights like this.
Yeah, I think this part was a rewrite.
Yeah.
But also, I love how it's Jingle Bell Rock, like a rock of cocaine.
Oh, good one. She walks on a ledge and throws herself off. And apparently this actress did this actual stunt herself. It's an attention grabber, but am I the only one, and maybe it's just because I'm older since I was a teenager, am I the only one who finds it a tad exploitive?
I don't, because it's the 80s, and, you know, this movie kind of represents the heyday of that type of... Like, Shane Black has a very strong, I would say, seething hatred of Los Angeles. And that's putting it mildly. think, like, this is kind of him showing that this is the height of both sleaze, but also, like, excess. Which a lot of 80s action movies... I mean, look, this came out the same year as RoboCop.
Yeah.
And much like RoboCop, this is a commentary on Reagan's America in certain ways. So what's also great about this opening is that it seems pretty cut and dry that she commits suicide. But like a lot of Shane Black movies, in fact, almost all of them, the inciting incident is a lot more elaborate than you're led to believe, and it slowly gets unraveled. I like this approach a lot. Although I compare Shane Black to, if you've ever seen the movie The Big Sleep, which is what people call, the plotting for that movie is almost nonsensical. And Black kind of uses that logic for his writing, where it's not the actual plot. The journey is more fun than the ultimate destination. That's kind of how I view his philosophy.
But my first note is, we're opening with Christmas and snow, even if it's not the kind of snow we think. You know, I could see where in current age, you know, in the mid-2020s, people would say, oh, how exploitive is this? Well, you know what? It's also kind of beautifully shot, the way that it's done. And I appreciate it, not just because I get a bare breast up on screen. But exploitive would be so many of the directors that get some stripper fake bolt-ons and they're just thrust there in front of the camera. And it's not done that way. Yes, it ends with her on top of a car and they just happen to pull back that rope to fully expose one of her breasts. But it's not done in a way that feels demeaning. It's a grabber to start a film. How many Christmas movies do you know that start off with a line of coke and jumping off a building? I can think of one. This is it. To Matt's point, and Shane Black and his thoughts of Hollywood and just the debauchery that goes on, there's so many lines and moments and places they visit in this film that make me think of True Romance and go, man, Shane Black, even way back in the 80s, was really onto something with the way that Hollywood is just a debaucherous kind of city.
A lot of things make me think of Joel Silver, which makes me think of Saul Robinac from True Romance.
Exactly.
And this is one of them. We cut to a suburban house, and we see Darlene Love, singer of my favorite Christmas song, Christmas Baby, Please Come Home, and her family walk into the bathroom as Murtaugh is taking a bath. And they wish him a happy retirement. Now, Glover's 40 when this is filmed. His 27-year-old daughter, Tracy Wolf, is here, playing 16 years old. She comes in and says that his beard makes him look old, that she's looking right where his fucking private parts are. And can I say just how much I hate the saxophone soundtrack the series has? Every time we're trying to punctuate a joke, we have to play a fucking sax in the background. This opening scene, this introduction to Danny Glover's Roger Murtaugh is, I don't know, it's kind of weird.
So I like the way that the two leads are introduced as total opposites, you know, because he is the family man, very sort of low key. But I also love how this establishes that everyone's perception of him is wrong, because there's that line about the beard and then he trims it into a mustache and then the guy at work says, oh, it makes you look older. So it's like, he's like, I can't fucking win. But I like that he's just your believable average guy, which was not the kind of person who was leading the majority of these films at the time.
I love this introduction. And the reason is, you don't get this. I mean, this is the Cosby family in an action movie. That's what we're getting here. And I like it. I like it quite a bit. I love the family, his daughter. I think she, you know, regardless of her age, I think she looks, look, there's an ethnicity part that makes it more flexible when it comes to ages. White people, we age like milk. Not good. There's a lot of other races that have a lot more, you know, leeway. So I think he could look 35 to 50. I think his daughter looks perfectly 16-ish, especially the way that she dresses, does her hair, and flirts with Riggs a little bit later on. But I love this introduction as a family, and it gives us so much information as to this loving, doting wife, kids, and just a good family man. Like I said, it feels like the Huxtable family put here in an action film, and it's something we would not have expected for this kind of movie. You don't see this at this point.
You make a great point. The Cosby Show would have premiered, what, the year before this, right? Like 86, something like that?
Two, I think, yeah.
That would have been very popular, and they are kind of putting that particular family in this movie. I didn't think about that, but you're right. We then cut to a dog, enter a trailer, as good old Riggs, complete with obligatory Mel Gibson ass shot, wakes up to Family Feud and grabs a beer.
This is the second movie, by the way, in 1987 that Richard Dawson has a prominent role in.
That's right. And we're going to cover that one next year.
Can't wait to discuss that one. That's right.
Good call. So this is our introduction to our other member of this team that's eventually going to be put together. You know, they inverted the initials. I didn't catch that till this viewing, but we have Roger Murtaugh, Martin Riggs. How do you guys feel about the way we're introduced to our other member of this team?
It's okay, though I haven't seen him and I know there's different cuts. I know of the different versions that they did for Riggs' introduction. I like the one of him on the beach where we actually find him getting the dog, because that's an important part going forward. The one of him as a sniper I don't think is necessary. In fact, I think that would have been a shitty way to start it. But I don't think this is great. I think it's fine. But I do think it works as an opposite juxtaposition of what we just got with Murtaugh.
The original Black script, as I mentioned, was very dark. And his original introduction for this character was, there was, believe it or not, a school shooter inside a school. And Riggs' way of solving it was to ask for a fucking rocket launcher to blow the whole place up so that at least we got the main shooter of the school. That's how dark Shane Black's script got.
Yeah, and for the record, though, this movie, I think a lot of people, because if you haven't seen it in a while, you forget how dark it actually is when you analyze that.
Yeah.
This movie, everyone, all the main characters are Vietnam vets, and they all have different ways of coping. As far as the Riggs introduction, what I like so much about it is that, much like the Murtaugh intro, it doesn't tell you every single crucial detail right away. This doesn't show his hand that he's suicidal. It doesn't outright say that his wife is dead. Because if you knew that, I think it misconstrues how you view the scene with him at the Christmas tree farm in a little bit. Like, a lot of Shane Black stuff, you don't get it at face value. A lot of times he'll sort of drop you almost mid-conversation with some of his dialogue exchanges and even some introductions. So I like this quite a bit. And I definitely think the school shooter thing, not only is that kind of poor taste, but also I think it kind of misrepresents what the character is actually about, because when you find out what he did in Vietnam, it adds a lot of poignancy to why he's such a mess. Mm. That if you got that right away, it kind of lose its power.
We cut back to the Murtaugh family house, which also has Family Feud on, by the way. And we hear Trish tell Roger that she's thinking of going on Jeopardy, to which Roger replies with, "Just don't take any questions on cooking." Trish brings up that Michael Hunsaker called the office and he's been trying to reach Roger for 3 days. She asks why she's never heard of Michael, and it's revealed that he was a Vietnam buddy of Roger's. Roger doesn't approve of his daughter's prom dress. More on this later. We cut to Roger heading to the scene of the girl who jumped. We see a fellow hooker all dressed up with no one to blow, which I actually thought was a funny line. Roger says that Amanda Hunsaker was the jumper, and Roger hears the reason why Michael was looking for him. He calls Trish and asks for the number, and then we cut to Riggs testing out some cocaine while at a Christmas tree lot, and we find out that he's actually an undercover cop. One of these people is very famous, but one of these people is actually Anthony Kiedis' dad.
That's the one that looks like Razor Ramon?
Yeah. He hears the price as being 100. Riggs starts counting out 100 bucks, but it's actually 100,000. He says that he can't afford it, but he says that he'll take the whole stash and they can go to jail. Riggs proves the badge is real by imitating the Three Stooges, and a shootout is ensued.
So the Three Stooges thing, that's an ad-lib from Mel Gibson.
It is.
He is,
of course,
notoriously a big Three Stooges fan, so much so mm-hmm. he directed the TV movie.
And he produced the biopic that the Farrelly brothers did.
Well, it wasn't a biopic if you actually saw it. It was intended to be a biopic, and then they turned it into a Three Stooges movie with actors playing those characters.
Oof.
Yeah, it's not great. But I love how he just fucks with these guys by literally counting out the money, even though he knows fully that they're asking for $100,000.
I think it's fantastic. It's funny. It gives you so much info about Riggs just by having the scene play out. You're not dealing with exposition. You're not dealing with somebody else telling you, though we get a shrink later on giving you details. This just gives you part of who he is. What cracks me up is the action kicks in. I forget how 80s gunshots sound like I'm listening to cannons being shot from the bow of a warship.
Well, we talked about that when we talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's kind of the same thing, you know?
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Riggs' backup shows up, and then he's taken hostage. Riggs tells his partners to shoot him before escaping his grip and grabbing him. The guy looks Gibson's crazy eyes and just takes off. We cut back to the trailer as we see Riggs struggle to keep from shooting himself, and it's here where we see some indication that he had a past life that went awry. He's looking into the barrel of a gun, still wearing his wedding ring. We see a Bugs Bunny cartoon. What do you guys feel about the almost Riggs suicide scene here?
I think it's poignant. I think it's wonderfully horrific. It really makes you feel. I think Gibson brings some amazing emotionality every time they go through that suicide possibility when he's discussing his dead wife. It's heartbreaking, and you feel it. And again, this is not the kind of movie you expect it, at least not without a joke or a punchline. And if they made this movie today, there would be a joke or a punchline. And instead, it's just character development, and it's done really fucking well.
Spoiler alert, when he stops being the suicidal, he gets boring. So, yeah, I agree with you in this movie. Matt, what do you think?
Well, he doesn't stop being suicidal till the end of the movie.
It happens a little before that, but we'll get to that when we get to it.
Well, these guys are regular. They're regular people who are dealing with the fallout of horrific shit. They're not the killing machine, well, the soulless killing machines of, say, like your Terminators around this time, or Commando, where it's kind of like you're laughing at what's happening. I mean, there's funny stuff at this movie, but like I said, when you really break it down, it's kind of, it's almost a horror movie in a lot of ways.
And by the way, this is the scene that the director of The Hamlet that came out a couple years before had seen and really liked, and that's why he asked Mel Gibson to be in that. We see some cops singing Silent Night, and then we see the cop psychologist. By the way, this chick was married to Robert Zemeckis for a set of years. Died in 2009. But she's a small part of these films. And she tries convincing the police captain that Riggs has no business being on the force because of his psychological issues.
And she's 100% right, by the way.
Oh, absolutely she is. This guy has no business being on the fucking force. This captain, by the way, he's been most of Donner's work. Donner used to use him a lot. We cut to Roger being told not to show his emotions as he gets the Hunsaker files that tell him that the girl didn't kill herself and there's evidence that the pills were doctored. Oh, boy. You know, I want to get to this right now. This movie is too fucking convoluted. There's no reason to show this chick jump, and then we're being told that this hooker went in and actually doctored these pills, which we'll eventually find out. It's just too fucking convoluted to get to this guy who is working this whole drug ring. This movie's fucking complicated, and it has no business being so.
I agree. At one, I don't know how you doctor these pills with whatever they were going through. I think this movie, this script got changed drastically after Beverly Hills Cop. I think, one, you could almost file a lawsuit, but I think all the changes to make this dark into a buddy cop, I know they said that they didn't want specific races when they were casting, but I think the ridiculous success and press of Beverly Hills Cop really changed what this movie was going to be. And when you look at the plot of this and the drugs and the coast that it's on, it's amazing how much parallels between those two. This obviously has a lot more action into it, but this is when I start to really go, I swear I just watched this in another movie not that long ago.
It personally doesn't bother me.
Roger is also told that he looks younger with the beard, as Matt mentioned earlier, and that he has a new partner who's on the edge. Roger sees Riggs getting his gun out, and this is how these two meet. And of course, this is the second uttering of the phrase, I'm too old for this shit.
It's got a line that I could not help but laugh at when they were talking about, 80s guys are just too soft nowadays.
Yes.
It just makes me think that no matter what year and what decade this is, everybody's just gone too soft. And okay, it makes me know that this has never ended, because that's a 35, 37-year-old joke that you would hear if they made this movie today.
That's right, that the too old for the shit, that's like the most quoted line, but it's the second most used running joke in the movie.
And he's only 40, by the way, which makes me feel really old. I mean, I know he's playing 50, but he's 40 years old saying these fucking lines.
37 years ago, you used to have a retirement at that age.
Yeah.
Thanks, America.
Exactly. So Riggs and Murtaugh, they get to know each other a little bit, and we learn that Riggs was in the war and that the firepower Riggs is carrying is serious shit. Rogers told a lot of old-timers carry his type of gun, and the fact that he knows all the martial arts means that, of course, Riggs can be registered as a lethal weapon. Oh, of course, we got to utter the fucking title. We also learn that they're both fucked, as no one wants to work with Riggs, including Murtaugh. When Roger says God hates him, Riggs replies with hate him back. It works for me.
Such a good line. Well, he also has like the great explanation of, well, if I'm faking my psychosis, I'm not getting my pension, so I'm fucked either way.
Yeah. We then get to the obligatory introductory scene to this movie's baddies, and it's here where we meet Gary Busey's Mr. Joshua. And let's talk about Gary Busey. You know, we're going to be talking about him when we get to Silver Bullet in the next couple years, at least. Compare him in that movie, which was 2 years before this, and him here. It's two different people. He worked really hard. He lost 60 pounds, and he swore that, you know, he was clean, and they brought him in. And you know what? As the odd job of this film, I like Gary Busey. It revived Busey's career.
Yeah, and it's, I think he's one of the great 80s movie, these type of action villains. But he's sort of the Red Grant mold, not just because he's blonde. But, you know, he's the muscle who's actually the more memorable one of the two.
Yeah, because it's not till later that we actually know that it's McAllister who's the brains behind it, you know.
Well, you can kind of assume that based on what he does with his arm.
He's so damn good in this. He carries a menace without the craziness that you associate with him nowadays. I knew him from Buddy Holly by the time I had watched this film, but I think he's fantastic in that, you know, obviously. But yeah, this is kind of what I think of when I think of Gary Busey. If they were to remake this nowadays, or if they ever make five, hire Jake and let him be a new Mr. Joshua. That would be awesome.
Well, he was basically in this movie pre-motorcycle accident. He was sort of Nick Cage before what Nicolas Cage turned into.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a good point. And then, of course, we get this lighter under the arm trick, which I don't care who you were in the late 80s. You tried this. I know I did.
It sure did.
We see Roger visiting Mike Hunsaker. Good old Tom Atkins himself, and he tells him of the fact that even if his daughter hadn't have jumped, she would have been dead anyway. Mike tells Roger that he had heard he was working out there and that he might be able to get her out of the stuff that she was getting into, which included making pornographic videotapes.
Which is also a underlying thing in a lot of Shane Black movies, because there's Last Boy Scout has a little bit of that with the Halle Berry character, the Nice Guys, kind of the crux of the movie in a lot of ways. This is also very good against type casting because Tom Atkins typically plays the guy who should be in the force shooting people.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that he's in this movie, but he doesn't get to fire a gun.
Mike then tells Roger that he owed him, and he wants Roger to find whoever's responsible for this. He says he wants Roger to find them and kill them. On the way to the car, Roger tells Riggs that Mike took a bayonet to the lungs to save his life, and Riggs replies, well, that was nice of him. They get a call of a building jumper, so Riggs cheers and heads that way. We get to the building, and Martin says that he can handle this. We cut to Riggs on the building. He approaches the jumper and says, Merry Christmas, and he asks why he's jumping, and he's not getting any response. He goes out on the ledge, and the guy keeps threatening to jump, but Martin says that he just wants to talk to him. Riggs says that he's not the first person to think of this, and there's a little back and forth as Riggs says that his boss is down there, and he doesn't want to look bad. So as he gets close, he offers a smile, saying that if they take their time, they'll both die of cancer.
This is so well written because what you're getting a lot of who he is here. You know, he's not just we know he's not some crazy wacko, but this is really showcasing it. But also the lines that are written, the way that it's done is there's some thought behind it. It's much more clever than I think this movie usually would get credit for.
Yeah. Also, he's also not lying where he's saying like, you know, I speak from experience on the subject. And, you know, it also leads into the thing. Maybe he does have a, you know, an ultimate death wish with the cuff. Ultimatum.
So as Riggs reaches for the cigarette, he locks the cuffs and throws away the key. He says that if the guy jumps, now he'll be a murderer. He shows the crazy eyes again as he takes the guy on the jump. They land in a bag and Riggs asks if he wants to go again. That was a line that my dad always laughed at. He laughed so hard at that line.
I have never thought until this viewing how much when Mike in 89 Batman, you want to get nuts? Let's get nuts. It's this.
Michael Keaton.
Yeah, Michael Keaton. It's Riggs being like, do you want to jump? Do you want to? It's the exact same inflection. It is the exact same performance. And I never noticed it till this watch.
Roger confronts Riggs and they go to an abandoned shop. He asks Riggs if he wants to die and offers his gun to help. It's here that Roger learns that Riggs is in fact suicidal as he was told, as Riggs says that every day he thinks of a reason not to do it, which is how much he likes his job.
I love how he's so mad that he freaking swings the door until it comes all the way back around.
Yes, those doors don't do that.
One thing I noticed here that I never noticed before is that Roger saves his life. Because Riggs did pull that trigger, and it's Roger that grabs the hammer to stop it from going.
Yeah, he would have done it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So after this, Riggs says that he's hungry, he's going to go get something to eat. Roger talks to a psychologist, and she tells him that she thinks Martin has a death wish. She also says that if he goes, you don't want to be anywhere near him. Riggs asks Roger if he's hungry and offers him a french fry.
I think we've said this to each other after watching this. Here, go get a french fry. You want a french fry?
Adam and I fucking used this line so much after we watched this. Like, we would say it to each other. We'd be in the car, go get Burger King or something, and we would offer each other fries, go, here, have a french fry. This was our line. This is where we're getting some more little mini exposition as Roger is bitching that it's his birthday and Rick says that he didn't know it was his birthday. Rick says that he avoids driving and Roger says that he's been driving since Riggs was itching his daddy's pants. This conversation at least has them both laughing and we haven't really seen this since we've really gotten into the film. So here they're finally being cordial with one another.
They are. And this is also, you start to get these jokes that will come back over and over throughout the movie and throughout the entire series. The I'm going to drive. This banter is so well done. You would think these guys have been buddies forever, but you can still see it building. This is good stuff. You get the joke that will repeat over and over things like, I'm going to drive. And you feel like these two have been buddies forever, even though it's still building. Like, this is just great work of this relationship.
Well, especially because now they realize they're stuck together. It's literally the definition of playing nice with your coworkers.
Yeah, this is where I get a real good feel of what's going to drive this series. And I'm going to go ahead and say this now. I think whatever story kinks and whatever story faults that the rest of the series has, it's going to live and die around their chemistry. And this is where we really establish the chemistry these two have. And no matter what goes wrong with the series, at least they have this particular chemistry between them. And that's what makes the series work for me. Because the majority of the series, including this one, I don't think there's really good writing to be had. But with them going back and forth like this, it works.
I think there is. I think the running gag they have in a little bit is one of my, like, your French fry gag is me with the line about anorexic. Where they're explaining how thin the plot is for all intents and purposes.
Anorexic thin. Yeah, totally thin.
Okay, so they head to the house of what they're thinking is Amanda's boyfriend. They're invited in and they walk through what seems like the Garden of Eden as two girls notice them and walk away and shots ring out. The girls are brought outside and tied to a tree as Riggs walks the property and Roger brags about shooting the suspect in the leg and not killing him. The guy then brings out a gun as Martin and the suspect land in a pool cover and my God, is this a fucking nightmare of mine, drowning in a goddamn pool cover.
It was a nightmare for them too because they couldn't see him in time. I also love how, like, they're the most overconfident cops in the world because they think they're here just to make a citizen's arrest.
And I know.
They walk into, like, a pornographic drug ring.
What I like about this scene so much is this is Shane Black going, I have seen these houses. I have seen these parties. This is what I was exposed to, and it's why I'm leaving the city. I think he is telling on Hollywood decades before we get the scandals we're currently dealing with.
There's also, they echo this later on with him pulling out a gun. With Mr. Joshua at the end.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a little tease of what's going to happen later.
As Matt implied, they can't cut this guy loose in time and he drowns. They appear on the surface and Riggs just goes, oops. And Roger asks if Riggs has ever met somebody he hasn't killed, which I actually thought was a good line. Roger apologizes for what he told Riggs earlier and thanks him for saving his life. He then says that Riggs will never know how much that hurt to say. We cut back to the Murtaugh household as Roger brings his suicidal partner to a family dinner. And this is where we learn of a crush that Martin's daughter has on Riggs and get to know the kids and Trish a little more. And you know what? If Tracy Wolf wasn't 27, literally a few years younger than Mel Gibson when this was filmed, I would find this to be way creepy. But as it is, I think it plays off okay.
I don't even mind age change or, you know, what it's being portrayed as because it's a teenager with a crush. You know, she's about to go off to college, so she's right in that type of range. I love this, though, because it's like a party scene in a movie. You're getting so much development just by having a scene exist and just letting them act around each other. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I think the human touches in this movie are what make it stand out. There's actual dimension to these people as people, like with relationships and, you know, something as innocuous as a crush on a dad's coworker. Like, there were a lot of sitcoms where that was like a subplot for a full episode.
Yeah, and I think what you mentioned there, that's stuff that Ridley Scott would not have brought to this movie. That is all Richard Donner. He did the same with Superman. We mentioned during that, you know, there's a lot of human emotions and things not associated with the job that has to be done in that film, and he brings that to this series as well. We hear a little song, and Roger has some issues beatboxing. We cut to Trish taking out the garbage as Roger entertains their guest. Roger and Martin, they talk about Roger's boat, and Roger gets him another beer, and Rick says that things get complicated all by themselves. They talk about the case some more, discussing theories that Riggs just doesn't buy before their boat turns on. Rianne comes out to ask if she can go to the club with Mark, and Roger says that she's grounded due to smoking pot. Boy, remember when pot was illegal, boys?
It just made me laugh because I look at it in today's day and age. Because he specifically says, as of right now, grass is still illegal.
Yes, like, I caught that too.
Like, it took decades, but how prophetic.
Yeah. Riggs asked Roger to just have a heart, let her go. Martin starts heading home while complimenting Roger on his nice family. We end on a pivotal note of Roger not yet trusting Riggs, saying that if they can get through tomorrow without him killing anyone, they'll talk about trust. And you know what? As I've mentioned in this podcast, I'm not really big on Shane Black's script for this film, but I will say this. I love how he uses small little exchanges to do exposition. And we get a lot of that here. Like, this is where we learn of how good a shot Riggs is. And he says it's the only thing he has ever been good at. And that comes into play later on in the film. That is very well done.
That's also why that school shooter scene needed to be removed. Because this is the linchpin to this whole character. Not only was he in Vietnam, but he was Black Ops. And he talks about how, like, he shot a kid and only, like, 10 people in the world can make that shot. So you realize why he's such a wreck. And then you compound it with his wife dying and something as random as a car accident. Which I'm glad. Another thing I like about this movie, they don't show flashbacks to the wife dying. There's no flashback to the two of them talking or fighting or what have you. It's there. It's important. There's a resolution to it at the end. We're not going to, I don't want to say waste time because it's under 2 hours. I mean, it's not overly length. But I don't think everything you're told... You get to begin, like, when he finds out that Tom Atkins called him, it's like, oh, I knew this guy for 20 years. Like, he doesn't tell his wife the full backstory because it's not, they wouldn't do that in that situation. So, again, I think the script here is really good. I don't think it's Shane Black's best script, and I also don't think it's his purest one because I do see some plot compromises that Adam alluded to. I do think not just Beverly Hills Cop 1, a little bit of the second one, too, because that one is much more of an action movie.
It should also be said, before I go to Adam, it should also be said that Donner did bring in Jeffrey Boehm to do touch-ups on this, and I think a lot of the human stuff that comes out of this is due to that, because, like I said, that Shane Black script was way dark. Adam, how do you feel about how exposition is used here?
I think it's used well. Everything matters. It's amazing how economical it works. You know, at least at this point, things are set up, things matter. The lines that are delivered are there for a reason, and I think it's a really good piece of screenwriting, especially for someone at his age, at this point of his career. It's pretty remarkable what he was able to pull off with this script. So, yeah, I mean, it's very well done. I'm not saying it doesn't have issues, but it is really impressive, especially this industry, this time of the 80s.
Especially with how many hands this went through.
Yep.
Like, because this is long before a lot of screenwriters had the pull to be on set saying, no, do it like this or don't change that. You know, because he's a 22-year-old kid who sold off his script. Like, you really think he's going to have that much? That's like signing your kid away in a lot of ways for your first movie.
We cut to Roger yelling at the cat. I do this every day.
Yeah, I was going to say, you could use this as the outtake footage because you've done it in real life.
Yeah, I just did this at the end of the Children of the Corn show. As he sees some cards as well as a toy cop set, he opens another package which contains a yearbook and what happens to be one of Amanda's finest cinematic achievements, apparently. We see Roger getting woken up by a cup of coffee held by Riggs, and he tells Roger that he needs to get up because they need to catch bad guys. We cut to some target practice, and we're hearing more theories about Trixie planting the pills and how she was the one who flagged down the police after her death. And again, this is just a great exchange. Riggs is sitting there like, yeah, he actually said shit as he's firing his gun. And when Roger says that if Riggs keeps putting down his wife's cooking, he won't be invited over for Christmas dinner, Martin says that his luck is changing for the better all the time.
This is another one. Her cooking is a running joke through four films. It starts here. So is the cat. Jokes about cats to run through this entire series as well.
Yeah, that's right. I have a big problem with this, though. Shane Black doesn't write women very well.
No, he doesn't. He is the Frank Miller of screenwriting that way.
Yeah, except at least Shane Black will put a woman at the center of his script with One Kiss Goodnight.
Yeah, true.
I think that's the exception to your rule.
Let me go back. At this point, he did not write women very well at all. And they're all used in here as either a joke or just things to get the men to do what they're supposed to do. That's it. They're not real integral to this plot.
Or they're there to be kidnapped. Like, it's, yeah. I mean, look, that was the whole crux of the, the whole point of Commando.
You're right.
That they abduct Alyssa Milano, which is something a lot of teenagers want to do every weekend.
You're not wrong.
Die Hard, John McClane, his family, including his wife and daughter, taken hostage.
I see it, and you are not wrong. I don't blame Shane Black as much as just acknowledge that was what movies were. Period. You were not expecting women to go see this film. You just weren't. So it was accepted that that's how you were going to write it.
We didn't get a bit that shows Rick shooting a happy face on a target, and this is... I find this the B. Gibson as most annoying when he's doing this shit.
But he would be annoyed in that spot, which is why I think it works so well. He knows how to, like, bust his balls without outright doing it. It's one-upsmanship.
I need this banter, and I think these two together are fantastic. And I need this, because this is when I feel like the exposition they're given, to steal a line, we start to get thin. We start to go a little anorexic, where I'm not paying attention to the plot machinations. I just want to see these two have fun and shoot stuff up.
We cut to Riggs and Murtaugh pulling over at the Trixie house. And by the way, at this point, these two think that this case is over. And it's only at Martin's insistence that they go here. And we see that the house, miraculously, as soon as they show up, blows up. We get a big explosion. And, of course, we're seeing a lot of these in these movies at this point. You know, big explosions with the heroes just right there running away from it.
Yep, and they're totally okay.
Yeah, perfectly fine. Roger reiterates that the lead was thin, but Ridge somehow gets out of one of the kids not only who the guy was, but the guy who planted the bomb had a War Forces special tattoo. Oh, this is dumb. And you know what? Donner does say on the commentary that they literally had no idea how to identify who this was, and they knew they had to do that in order to get the big fight at the end. This is what they came up with on the spot, and it's not good. Even though I'll always go for a good GoBots reference and a Big Bird reference, this is just silly.
I think the tattoo is... The reason I support it is because a lazier movie would have had Riggs showing him the tattoo at one point, and that would have been established as a plot point. But when you realize, oh, they have... That's somewhat plausible. It's anorexic, it's thin, but it's at least plausible. And again, like, Shane Black is one of those people, he thinks kids are a lot smarter than they actually are in a lot of his movies, where it's sort of the opposite or the same thing as Shyamalan, where the adults talk like kids, or the kids talk like adults in some of his work. Except Last Action Hero, everyone wanted to smack that kid sideways.
Bottle glasses, that kid's got magnifiers on to see that tattoo. It's not very big. Yeah,
those 3D glasses were badass. This kid has Batman level of observation.
I know. It's a, yeah, math point. It's thin. It's paper thin. But I like the way that it's done. He points on it, and Evan Riggs like, are you sure? And then he pulls Murtaugh away and goes, hey, this is what this is. A different script would be like, oh my God, kid, you saw a Special Forces tattoo. This Special Forces tattoo mean blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So it's tenuous, but a lot of this starts to get tenuous. The difference is I'm having fun. So yeah. when these things happen and I'm like, oof, that's a rough way to get there, I don't care. Because it's just, there's something fun the way that it's done.
The other defense of it I'll give is that it's one thing if it was just the tattoo. There is also the thing of the grenade, the explosive that
the mercury device.
Yeah, yep. The mercury switch that they only, like, the CIA used that Riggs had experience with that. At least that's more definitive than the tattoo. So I like that that's also there. If it was just the tattoo, I'd be like, all right, that's a little too convenient.
As I was writing notes in this, I have a harder time that in the mid to late 80s, Riggs is still age appropriate enough that he's got all this Vietnam.
Yeah. I was going to bring that up later.
I'm like, you know, I don't know if Shane Black has got his years exactly right, you know, for how some of this was done. So I think he gets out of it by saying that Riggs started, he went over there when he was like 19.
And at this point, Mel Gibson's 30, and he's playing someone who's 38. So I guess that kind of lines up. It does line up to 19, but yeah, it's pretty thin. Yeah.
The Australian sun, it'll age you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, well, so does anti-Semitism.
Yeah, no shit. We got back to Michael's as Roger asked what it was that got his daughter killed. And during this, he's asking Michael to keep his hands out of his pockets. Michael says that it goes back to the war, and in Air America, they killed everyone. They also formed a plan to bring heroin into the country, 2 shipments a year, run by ex-CIA and mercs. Michael says that they need him, as this is big business. Oh, God. So they killed his daughter. It's just, goddamn. Yeah, why not just kill him?
He's doing, and I sent this to us. He's doing the exposition, and I'm popped so hard because I'm like, oh, my God, I know the story. This is the plot of Air America with Robert Downey. With Robert Downey Jr.
No, but Mel Gibson, isn't he in it?
And Mel Gibson.
Yeah, Mel Gibson is his partner.
They're co-stars. Mm-hmm. And then he actually uses the phrase, Air America, and I'm like, holy shit, I can't believe it. One, it's an enjoyable movie. I recommend people go check it out. This is exactly what that movie is. So imagine this drug running in Laos being done, and Mel Gibson is running the drugs. That's what Air America is.
Yeah, this is also Shane Black's middle finger to how the Iran-Contra situation happened.
Worked out. Yep.
Yeah, and all Ronald Reagan's other phony war on drugs and whatnot. Yeah, well, they killed his daughter because he was going to blow the whistle, and they still needed him to launder the money.
This is but with treated pills. Okay. This is when a helicopter shows up and shoots Michael right through the eggnog.
This is the most like this how you know it's the 80s. They send a helicopter to kill one guy.
Yeah, Black would use this again in Iron Man 3.
This is from a Manchurian Candidate, the original.
Good call. Yeah. Roger tells him that he got off easy as Riggs fires away at the helicopter, which is also very 80s, Matt. Like, the helicopter is about 30 feet away, but Riggs is still firing away his pistol right at it.
Yeah, although if this was like a Bond movie, he would have taken the helicopter down with his handgun. Yep.
For Die Hard 2.
Die
Hard 3. Yep.
So the helicopter gets away, and McAllister tells Big Joshua that Hunsaker spoke to the police. We cut to Riggs talking to hookers as he shot at, and he goes right through the storefront window. And it turns out he was wearing his vest. And this is, Matt, where I find that he is not suicidal anymore, because if he was, he wouldn't have been wearing that fucking vest. He would have been shot.
Well, I think this was also a rewritten scene, because in the original script, he picks up a prostitute and he goes, "How old are you?" She goes, I'm as young as you want me to be. He hands her $100 and she goes, "What do you want to do?" He says, "I want you to come back to my place. The Three Stooges are on in 20 minutes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I did read that. Riggs somehow sees that the guy who shot him is the same one who shot Hunsaker. Boy, those are good eyes.
Well, the blonde hair is such a dead giveaway.
Yes.
He does look fully albino. Like the eyebrows, everything.
Yeah. Riggs adds that the fact that they think he's dead gives them the edge over the group who shot at them. Roger hears a description of the kid his daughter's dating, so they drive over to the house to storm in, only to see it deserted. So we're not going to see this boy that his daughter was going to take out, because he's already taken out.
He's like Reggie from Bad Boys. What do you think he's
Roger sees a note and a picture saying that they have Rianne. Trish and the other kids, they come out as the phone rings. Roger answers it, and Big Joshua tells him to stick by the phone if he wants to know where Rianne is. Joshua then calls the homicide division, disguising himself as a reporter, and even though he gave zero credentials whatsoever, this guy just gives away that Riggs was shot and killed.
Good thing they didn't take his son, because Mel Gibson would have been yelling, "Give me back my son," before 1996.
Very underrated film, by the way.
Yeah, except it has the most obvious twist.
Yeah, Riggs tells Roger that if he wants Rianne back, they need to go get her. Riggs says that they're going to get bloody on this one, and that they need to do things his way. Roger once again asks if Riggs is crazy, and Riggs says that he's going to have to trust him. The phone rings again, and they head out to the desert to get Rianne back. So he's taking them at their word.
Sorry, this conversation that they have when they're discussing this in front of the Christmas tree, the way that this is lit and staged, you could tell this movie literally is turning. There's been a lot of action. Yeah, there's been some darkness, but there's been some fun and buddy cop moments along the way. But it's bathed in a dark red light. They're in front of the tree. This thing goes dark from this point on out, and it's framed this way. And this scene, from here to the end of this film, this shit goes dark, dark.
So they're in the middle of some nice, clear California skies in the middle of December. I kind of miss these days of being in California during this time. We see a car and helicopter. They head out to Roger's location, and Riggs sets up to do some shooting. The helicopter lands, and Roger insists on seeing his daughter before turning himself over. She comes out of the car as Roger pulls a grenade out of his pocket, saying that if she's going to die, then he's going to die with her. Riggs keeps looking for a place to shoot as Roger tries buying some time. Roger gets shot as the smoke grenade goes off, and Riggs starts firing away. Rianne gets in the car and drives off as Riggs is found. They pursue Rianne as Roger is shot at, and the station wagon takes a beating. This fucking helicopter on this car, what a stunt. My God, just a few years after John Landis and The Twilight Zone were doing this shit.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would not want to be the insurance company who had to back this.
No. It's a compliment, don't get me wrong. It's just crazy that they went ahead with this.
It's also like, the movie is very economical with saving its money for the end. All the big set pieces are in the third act of the movie like it should be.
Except for one, but we'll get to that.
I like this. It's amazing, though, that one, the shot is done really well. This movie, with everything that happens and everything we're talking about, seems like it should be 30 to 40 minutes longer than it is. Everything is done very economical, and it's surprising how brisk this movie goes through when so much happens in it. But this is really well done, great action scene.
And you could also tell it's the 80s because we get blood squibs when people get shot. Yes. I mean, it's not quite Paul Verhoeven levels, but...
And they fly 20 feet when they get shot with a handgun.
Yeah, the stopping power on those bullets are insane.
Roger finally caves and puts his hands behind his head. We cut to Rianne getting shot at as the helicopter lands on the car and it breaks down. We cut to Riggs getting interrogated as we see this Asian guy who's in all these fucking 80s movies. This guy's in everything. Joshua brags about his large shipment of heroin, and he says that it's essential that they find all the cops who know the shipment. Riggs refuses, and here's where he's electrocuted. And, you know, Gibson had a really weird fascination with self-flagellation around this time. Like, between this, we had Braveheart of years later, and, of course, he directed Passion of the Christ. For some reason, he is so intent on showing himself or his star be completely annihilated, and that is just disturbing to me.
I think he's got a, like, a savior complex, because it's not just that. There's that scene in The Patriot has something similar.
Yeah,
this scene has always stuck with me, even when I haven't remembered that it was from Lethal Weapon. I'm like, oh, that getting electrified, and I even remember Enzo holding those ends of those things. Just something about it, and little things like Joshua hitting him back and realizing he was shocking himself by throwing him back into him, you know, just to make it a little more realistic. There's not any chuff. That's just, everything matters. But this scene, ugh, it gives me the creeps. It just feels really disturbing. Like I said, this is like the, dark.
This is the rope scene from Casino Royale.
Good call.
We cut to Murtaugh, who's also not giving anything away and getting beat up for it. And we cut to Rian being brought in as Riggs fights his way out by killing this guy and pulling himself up. He goes to where Roger and Rian are being held and gets them out. And they go to the bar from earlier and shoot their way through.
I love how it takes someone getting shot for people to stop dancing.
I know.
I love that in movies.
We're going to be seeing that again when we get to John Wick later this
John
year.
John Wick, yep.
We see Joshua take a car and fire away at our heroes before driving off, and we get a car-slash-foot chase going on. Riggs firing off a bridge and Roger being stuck on foot. And, you know, I didn't know this, but I guess Mel Gibson can kind of compete with Tom Cruise on the running on film department. He runs fast with that fucking gun.
It's funny, though, because Mr. Joshua's running with his car, and Mel Gibson's shooting from his handgun at him. But then he's running, and he's got his AK-47 that he's got hanging from his side. You know, choose your weapon more, a little more carefully, soldier. But chasing him down on foot, it made me think of Men in Black. You chase down a cephalopod on foot? Way to go, kid.
We've seen a lot of Mel Gibson in a sharpshooting, but we haven't really seen a lot of what Roger can do. But here we get some Murtaugh action, as, you know, this is what he does. He cranks his neck before shooting the driver of the car that McAllister is in, and it gets toppled by a bus. This is stuff that Roger does, and I like that Donner finally gives him his moment here.
He gives him his moment without turning him into a superhero, which I like.
Right.
A lesser movie would have had him doing a foot chase. Or it would have been as big of a leap in logic as going to John McClane on the wings of planes. And I'm like, how the fuck is this a Die Hard movie?
Roger makes his way over to McAllister as the grenades blow the entire car to smithereens, and Roger has a nice laugh.
That explosion would be a lot bigger, by the way, for the if they're not just the oil, but you compound that with the grenades. That place would have lit up like Rockefeller Center, blow up the Christmas tree.
Don't forget, they only have $15 million to work with here. That's not a lot, even in 1987. Riggs tells Roger that Joshua got away, and Roger says that Joshua knows where he lives, so they need to find him. They get in the car and drive back towards Roger's house, and we see a set of cops taken out by Joshua as he then does the convenient thing of taking out this fire hydrant, and this is where the $15 million ran out, because the script actually had all of this being taken place in the rain. They couldn't afford to do it, so they just take out this fire hydrant and just spray them for the rest of this.
All right. So we also should mention one of the MVPs of this movie is Stuart Baird, who's the editor. Who is, I think, one of the best editors ever, if you look at his resume.
I agree.
Sadly, his directing career wasn't great. He made 3 movies. And then he went back to being a editor. He worked on Casino Royale, actually. He was the editor on that, ironically. He does such a good job editing this, what could be an incomprehensible action scene. Because water always makes it hard.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the one thing I'm like, why would this happen with 50 cops just watching? This is not Rocky V where everyone's watching a fight.
All right. Before we get there, and by the way, I think, Adam, you and I saw Executive Decision together. We didn't mind that. That was kind of fun. That
was where Steven Seagal gets sucked out of a plane was like the greatest thing.
Yes, 15 minutes in.
Yeah.
And he got all pissed off.
This has got the greatest Easter egg, though, and it's blink if you miss it. On the fridge inside the house, stay tuned for next week, it's an End Apartheid, Say South Africa sticker on the fridge.
Wow. Donner said that he got death threats after this, which is where next week's film comes from.
Wow.
So
he wouldn't have gotten death threats. You know why? Diplomatic immunity.
Save it. So Joshua goes to Roger's house saying how much he hates Christmas before we see the car drive right through the house. Riggs pulls him out and then asked Joshua if he wants a shot at the title. And so here we have fucking Danny Glover, Roger Murtaugh, refereeing a goddamn fight, like Matt says, Rocky V style. This is beyond stupid.
Well, he's not refereeing. He's Mickey. He's his corner man.
He's his corner man, and he's keeping other cops away. Why not shoot the motherfucker? Who cares?
Like, I get the purpose of it, where it's like these two guys are fighting to the death, but at no point is Joshua have any chance of winning because it could be rigged.
That's it!
Work.
Yes.
All Martin has to do is say, I give up, just shoot him.
My favorite part of doing research for this was when I found out there were 4 extra minutes here that they cut out. This would have been the They Live fight off.
No, that's exactly what I was thinking of. I'm like, this is the fight and They Live if it had some editing.
Oh, my God. So Roger keeps the others away, which makes no sense because this guy needs to be taken out. This just looks so ridiculous with everyone just standing and watching. We have shirts coming off, helicopter lights twirling, and we see Joshua almost drown Riggs in a puddle.
Oh,
and
yeah. I was thinking a glass with Bruce Willis.
Yeah, I was too.
And Murtaugh says, you get up, you son of a bitch, because Mickey loves you.
You know what? The dumbest thing they could have done, like a shitty movie would have done, is have him flash to his wife.
Yeah. You know what? If they did it today, that's what they would do.
So we see Joshua being taken out by scissors. At least we think he's taken out. We then get the big 80s thing of one last-ditch effort from the bad guy to take out our two heroes, but they both draw their weapons and shoot him at the same time. And I did rewind it and check this, boys. Yes, they both shot him. Two shots rang out, and they both hit him.
I cannot believe that this is exactly the Die Hard ending.
Mm-hmm.
It is the exact ending of Die Hard, with Carl Winslow deciding to pull his weapon. Jesus.
Well, Joel Silver did so much blow that he probably couldn't even distinguish which movie is which.
He had a storyboard and just kept reusing it as many times as possible.
Just kept reusing the same storyboard.
He's like, I don't know, they both got black guys with mustaches.
White guy? Which white guy? That white guy. That white guy.
Hold on one sec.
We cut to Riggs at his wife's grave. He drops some flowers and tells her Merry Christmas and that he loves her. We then cut to Martin showing up at the Murtaugh house. Rianne answers the door and Riggs tells her to give him a present from him, saying he won't be needing it anymore. It's a bullet. He starts leaving and Roger stops him, saying that he can't eat the world's worst Christmas turkey by himself. He then says that he thinks Rianne has a little crush on him, and chaos ensues. Roger says that he's too old for this, as credits roll on Lethal Weapon. Boys, what do you feel about the ending of this? And Matt, I know you know it's been changed, right?
Oh, yeah. I would say for the better.
Definitely agree with that.
I think it's a good, sweet ending. It's on the nose. I mean, you might as well put a treat on that dog. It's so on the nose, but I don't care. We actually get development. We get development that was set up and we got throughout the course of this film. So it's a good ending. It's an earned ending to this film.
And he gets a fully realized character arc. If this was the only movie, everything's resolved. And there's not that obvious, like, sequel bait. Granted, this came out at a time where, like, sequels were not churned out like they are now. But I like how it's self-contained.
You know what's terribly contained, though, and what a terrible way to end this was this goddamn theme song they play at the end of this. My God, they weren't even thinking about any fucking Billboard charts with this fucking song. I'm glad it wasn't the theme for the entire series. All right, scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Lethal Weapon? Adam, I am guessing you like this a little better than Children of the Corn 2020.
That's good guess. But yeah, that last one was more like Murtaugh's wife's cooking. I knew it had been a very long time since I'd gone back to this film, but I remember almost everything in it. I didn't necessarily remember how dark it was because it's been a long time since I've watched it in relation to start to finish, going credit to credit. But to give credit where it's due, Shane Black wrote a hell of a film. Is it derivative? It's derivative of some things, but I think it sets a standard for a lot of what comes after it. I do see a lot of 48 Hours in here. I do see a lot of Beverly Hills Cop in here. Absolutely. But I think he does a really good job writing characters you care about, of giving them differences while giving them inherent problems that don't feel supernatural, that don't feel superhero, that don't feel out of this world. And I think that's what makes this movie work. I love Murtaugh and his family. I care about Riggs and what he lost. And it's glossed over, but it's there and you care about it. The action is 80s big bombastic action. You're either going to go with it or you're not. I grew up in that era. It's fun. It is what it is. You got drugs. You got boobs. You got language. You got blow. I mean, this is kind of the quintessential 80s, but it's got some thoughtfulness to it. It's got some depth to the story that's being told. some of the story beats, yeah, they get a little thin. I know we've worked that joke the way that this script does, but I like its journey going all the way through. When this movie gets dark at the end, it gets really dark, and be prepared for that. I'm glad the changes that were made. I'm really glad that this one kind of set a touchstone for this more serious action movie, the more serious buddy cop action movie. It's not Beverly Hills Cop because it's just got more heft and weight to the characters, and it's dealing with more serious issues from a writer who detests the city that it's set in. And I think that's part of what helps it as well. This is a really good movie. I know a lot of people, when they think of Lethal Weapon, think of 2, think of 3. They think of Rene Russo. They think of Joe Pesci. They think of the characters that come later on. But this one really sets a good template. I'm at a strong 8. It's got issues, but I don't care about them when I'm watching it, because the delivery of the performances and editing, to Matt's point, and even the directing is just really, really good. It's amazing that the guy that did this went on to do Scrooged next. You know, it's just Donner. It's hard to compliment him enough because, man, as I said at the beginning of this, he's a renaissance man for directing because he just top of his game across. But solid 8 on 10. This movie's fucking great.
Wow. Was not expecting an 8. Mr. Bunch. Matt, what about you?
A lot of Adam's summarization are almost entirely applicable to my thoughts. If you haven't seen this in a long time, I'd encourage you to go back and watch it, not just because of the time of year, but I think there's a lot of very strong, not just writing tropes, but I think this shows how to bring character out of something that you think you've seen before. And buddy cop films often went to who can just compete for the most one-liners. That's not what this movie is. It's about how fucked up the Vietnam War made people. And that's, again, not something you would see just on the surface looking at this movie from, you know, a helicopter view. It's got problems. I mean, it's flimsy, but a lot of buddy cop films don't have the tightest of plots. I mean, you know, The Big Sleep is a great noir, but you ask people what that movie's about, you have to draw your own map. You look like Charlie from It's Always Sunny with the mail log, just trying to track shit. And for me, it's about the interplay. I think both Gibson and Glover came to play. I think they're both exceptional here. And I think it's a very well put together movie from a technical perspective. You know, this is why you get a Richard Donner to make a script that I think this would make for a great novel. I really would. It becomes cinematic because of the person behind the camera. And you got a great editor. It's a very, very good script. I don't think it's the best thing Black ever wrote. But look, if I could produce something like this at the age of 22, I'd be making a lot more money and I would not be doing these airwaves, I can tell you that. But I don't think it's not my favorite action movie of the 80s, but it's up there. There's a reason it spawned what it did, and I think we owe a lot to what this movie established. So I'm in lockstep as far as a score. I'm going to give this an 8 on 10 as well.
You guys are making me look like such an asshole.
Why stop now?
For Christmas miracle. We got our wish.
The teenage me ate all of this up. I ate all the lines up. I memorized them. Like I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, I didn't even really have to watch this, even though I hadn't seen it in over 20 years, because I knew all the lines by heart. So teenage me loved this movie. The adult me, as I watch this, the 40-plus-year-old guy who's watching this for the first time in many years, is wondering what would have happened if they would have brought Ridley Scott in to do this. Ridley Scott would do a movie a couple years after this called Black Rain that I think is rather good. I think if you bring that aesthetic to this, I'm not going to say it would have been a more pleasing movie, but I think it would have been a better movie. I think this script is a bit of a mess. I'm glad that Donner brought Jeffrey Boehm in to touch it up, because I think a lot of the lighter moments are thanks to him. What makes the movie work, though, and what's going to make this entire series work, as I mentioned earlier, is the chemistry of the two leads. I think by pairing Danny Glover and Mel Gibson together, you have a hell of a team that work very well off each other. But this is not a good script. I think the direction is rather good. I think it's some of the best directing of Donner's career. Go back to Superman, I had a lot of good things to say about his directing then. But the movie, the story itself, as you guys mentioned, it's very flimsy. I'm going to go lower. I'm going to go 2 points lower. I'm going to give this a 6. I still had a pretty good time with this. I'm not going to say I didn't have a good time. But in watching this, I think there are ways it could have been way better. So 6 out of 10 from me on Lethal Weapon. Next week, we have Lethal Weapon 2. Like I mentioned, this was my introduction to this series. I have memories of it. Adam, what are you expecting when we get to Lethal Weapon 2 next week?
They're going to be with the drive-thru. I remember Joe Pesci. And I remember the Black Community. Mm. Like, it's just, I remember it almost, I don't know, maybe caricature is a little mean, because I remember loving it. But when I think about it, I think about just big, kind of over-the-top line deliveries and moments and things like that. Not that this didn't have them. So I was surprised how much this held up, and I can't wait for next week to see if it does as well.
Matt, what are you expecting next week?
To be honest, the sequels, I haven't seen any of them in probably 10 years. So they're almost going to feel like first-time watches. I remember, okay. But I feel like I could say that about 3 and 4 because I know Pesci's in all of them. And I know the line that I referenced with that joke about Richard Donner being executed. But I'm excited to watch it. My memory of it is it feels more like a... sort of does the inverse of Beverly Hills Cop 1 into 2, where this one, I think, becomes more lighthearted from my recollection, but I could be wrong.
Yep, those are my memories as well. There's a different tone to next week's film, but I'm glad that my colleagues are back on their happy feet again after trudging through ears and ears of corn to end the year. We're starting this one off with a literal bang with the Lethal Weapon series, and I know that these conversations are going to get even more interesting as they go along because my memories of the sequels isn't very good. But until next week, when we get to Lethal Weapon 2, I'm too old for this podcast. Thank you, boys.
You sure are a crazy son of a bitch.
You think I'm crazy?
Yeah.
Are you calling me crazy? You think I'm crazy?
Yeah.
Hey, you want to see crazy? I'll tell you. Now, that's a real badge. I'm a real cop, and this is a real fucking gun.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Have a nice day.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Now I can read you guys your rights, but nah, you guys already know what your rights are, don't you?
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Hey, you said you liked it? That's a fair price.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
Aren't you going to miss all this good stuff when you retire? Aren't you going to miss it a little bit?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including Star Wars, the Mad Max movies, Avatar, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, Jurassic Park, Top Gun, and so many more.
Read them and weep.
We're partners. We are partners.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Oops.
Right, oops.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
God damn it, you were right, you know. Yeah, there wasn't enough room.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You haven't met anybody you didn't kill.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental. This podcast podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
I'm Sergeant Murtaugh. This is Sergeant Riggs.
How do you do? Nice to meet you. Okay, so what do I call you guys?
Sergeant Murtaugh, Sergeant Riggs.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
I'm going to be with you, Borna.
Hey, I'm with you now.
Look, I'm right here.
We're both here, right?
Right.
Come on, I want to be with you. What do you got to lose?
Let's do what one shepherd said to the other shepherd.
What?
Let's get the flock out of here.
Matt, you mentioned the other contenders. Christopher Lambert. Christopher Reeve was approached. I love when Adam does that laugh, and I laugh every single time he does. We had Michael Biehn. We cut to Roger heading to the scene of the girl who jumped, and we see a fellow. It says holler on my freaking iPad. I don't know why I typed that. We see a fellow hooker all dressed up with no one to blow.
Yeah, Australian sun, it'll age you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, well, so does anti-Semitism.
Yeah, no shit. There's a lot of. Maybe we'll get to that to see future sequels. I'll save it.
Oh, I know what you're going to say, yeah.
We cut back to Michael. We see McAllister, right? That's his name? Yep.
Yeah.
We see McAllister.
This guy, I laugh because every time I see this guy, I think of that fucking Halloween 6 bullshit.
Oh, God. Oh, God, that's right. He was in that.
Yeah, he's the leader of the cult.
Yeah. So the helicopter gets away and McAllister.
See? All done.